Marty Moss-Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. It's been a busy scene outside the U.S. Supreme Court this week with people protesting for and against the Affordable Care Act. That's the law passed 2 years ago to overhaul the country's healthcare system and is being argued inside the court this week. In fact, yesterday there was intense questioning of the Solicitor General about their requirement central to the law that people purchase health insurance. There would be a subsidy if you can't afford the insurance and a penalty paid through your income tax if you refuse to buy a policy. 26 states and the National Federation of Independent Business are challenging the constitutionality of the law. Healthcare represents about 17% of the U.S. economy, and millions are not insured. Today on Radio Times, we take a look at the Department of Health and Human Services v. Florida from a legal, medical, and political perspective. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. David Nash is an internist, and he's the dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health at Thomas Jefferson University. David Nash, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Ted Ruger is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, specializing in American constitutional law and health law. Ted Ruger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And rounding out our trio of guests is Dick Pullman, national political columnist. He writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's NewsWorks website and the American Debate column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Dick Pullman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Let me turn to you, Ted, if I could. Did the Solicitor General yesterday make his case for the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think he did his best to do so, but it was a tough argument for the Solicitor General. I think that's kind of widely accepted among folks who've listened to the argument. The justices, a number of justices, were challenging him quite pointedly, and in my view, they kind of sidetracked him from affirmatively defending this statute, which affects a real national interstate crisis, by kind of in my view, frankly, and I say this with all due respect as a law professor, the judges acted much more like law professors, kind of spinning out hypothetical after unrealistic hypothetical, too much so to my extent, instead of focusing on the case at hand and the specific problem of national health insurance.
But do you blame the Solicitor General, or are you saying that this is a hard case to argue before this particular court?
Well, I think— Look, I mean, we can second guess and find specific answers with the benefit of time that we might have answered more succinctly, but the justices collectively really pushed him beyond talking about the statute at hand into, we heard a lot about it. I almost felt like we were talking about the national auto industry and or the broccoli farmers. We heard a lot about cell phones and broccoli and
broccoli's
cars.
Broccoli's good for you.
And that to me suggests it's a certain judicial posture which doesn't bode well for the government and is arguably inappropriate for again, we do this in law classes all the time, but for the constitutional jurists considering an important statute, I think they ought to have been more focused on the operation of that statute itself.
Well, let me turn to you, David Nash, at least this week, this mandate, this requirement, that, and apparently mandate is not in the Affordable Care Act, that word,
right.
But nonetheless, the argument is that the government can compel people to buy health insurance as a way to cover everybody.
Well, if we're really going to do the ethical and moral thing, and that is cover millions of additional citizens, and that's what Congress and the Senate passed, and that's what the people wanted, and that's what the compromise achieved, it's a little silly here at the terrible twos. It's like March Madness in health policy. You have to have everybody paying a little bit to cover people who need the services. That's what insurance is all about.
But there seems to be public opinion against this notion of a mandate. People, I think it's something like three to five oppose it.
It is confusing to me and to lots of other people who pay attention to these issues why they're against it. And as Ted noted, you know, the penalties will be very modest. There'll be plenty of subsidies. This is a sideshow. This is not the core issue. The core issue is the system is broken. We have to fix it. Is this bill perfect? Certainly not. But we've made a lot of progress, and we're here today talking about the insurance aspect of the bill.
Right.
The delivery system aspect is moving quite quickly, and this town is at the center of a lot of that action.
And I do want to get to that. Dick Pullman, let me get you in on the conversation. What's so interesting is that this idea of a health insurance mandate comes from the 1990s, comes from the Heritage Foundation, was supported by conservatives, supported by Republicans, and now it's the issue that conservative and Republicans are fighting against.
Right, right. Well, you know, because there's a partisan strain now to the dialogue that was not there, that probably arguably was not as much there in previous generations. But, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Heritage Foundation talked about the mandate as an issue of individual responsibility back at like 20 years ago. Newt Gingrich talked about it himself when he was House Minority Whip. Mitt Romney incorporated it into the Massachusetts Health Plan, and they're, you know, they're on record talking about it that way. And in fact, and I wrote about this on the blog this morning, you know, one of the most interesting opinions so far about the health care mandate came from the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, and the opinion was written by, you know, a conservative jurist, an icon, and a Reagan appointee, who made the case for it. And so, you know, I think what's confusing, I think, for the public is rephrase that.
Okay.
The mandate, I think it's easier for, at least in terms of the spin war, and the political dimension of this is really all about the spin war and who's going to win it, is that the Republicans have a much easier job with the shorthand, the rhetorical shorthand, and to say that a mandate is an impingement on freedom. And it really comes down to whoever owns that word freedom.
Well, let me turn back to you, Ted Ruger, and even get back to this case and the argument. What is the government's argument then for this mandate, this requirement that everybody get health insurance?
Right. Well, the government's argument rests on over 60 years of kind of bedrock Commerce Clause jurisprudence. The government does have to find some part of the Constitution that justifies this exercise of authority. But since the New Deal, the Supreme Court has consistently held that the government can regulate even incremental individual economic choices if those choices, when aggregated together, have a substantial effect on the functioning of the national interstate economy. Nobody doubts that health insurance and the healthcare market has huge economic interstate effects, and nobody really, and I didn't really see any deconstruction of the basic proposition that every individual's choice of how to manage his or her medical risk by buying insurance or by rolling the dice and relying on free care is an economic choice that reverberates through the economy. That's the best case.
Well, let me turn to you, David Nash, because in talking about health insurance, if you have health insurance and I don't, and I end up going to the hospital, right, I get care.
You bet.
Because that's the way the system works, but you end up paying for some of my care.
Oh, we all end up paying, for sure. And I think that's the other issue that we're really not talking about. It's the gigantic elephant in this room. So while the Supreme Court is listening to these somewhat arcane arguments, Medicare is going bankrupt. The nation, if we keep on this track, in 25 years, hopefully we'll all be around still, we're going to be spending one out of three federal dollars on health care. So it's just unconscionable that, frankly, this is a sideshow. The core issues remain. We have to fix the delivery system. The current spending trend is not tenable.
But do we have to figure out how to get all the millions of uninsured
Absolutely.
Into the system, get them insured?
And we have a reasonable solution. Again, law of the land and the very core notion of what insurance is. Everybody participates for those when you need it. I'd like to talk to the people who are against the mandate and when they need care, especially in an emergency, how they're going to feel about it. It just continues to make very little sense.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Dick Bowman?
Well, something that David was just saying that brought to mind this notion of if the court does strike down the mandate and it goes back into Congress and what happens next, I would be very interested to see, and this is kind of, I don't expect the answer to this to be yes, I would be very interested to see whether the Republicans are going to have any interest in saying, okay, now that in the aftermath of this decision,
right,
what are we going to do to get the uninsured insured,
right,
you know, because they have absolutely no track record on that whatsoever.
That's right. But let's not forget that most of the delivery system changes, because again, we're talking about two different things, the insurance piece of this and the delivery system piece. Philadelphia is a great symbol of where the rest of the medical economy is going. I mean, all five medical schools, all 90 accredited hospitals, they're all working hard on the delivery system reform right now. We're seeing integration, we're seeing reduction in infection, we're seeing greater efficiencies, we're seeing changes in medical education, we're seeing interprofessional education. We have heard what the American people want. We're working hard to make those changes. this whole issue about insurance is just a silly sideshow.
Well, nonetheless, let me ask you, though, Ted Ruger. We, and I mean people that get paychecks, we pay for Social Security, we pay for Medicare out of our paychecks. Why is that not a model to use for the Affordable Care Act?
Great question.
Well, what's interesting about the discussion is even the justices who seem skeptical about the individual mandate were quite comfortable endorsing a capacious federal authority to tax and spend or use payroll taxes. So that we have an irony. If the ultimate goal here is protecting freedom, we have an irony that we have a statute here which attempts to tread quite lightly on private and, in a sense, channel people toward the free market system, right, not nationalize health care, not impose new taxes. Right. And it's ironic that that's encountering constitutional difficulty where much more invasive, quote, socialized solutions would be perfectly acceptable. That doesn't serve the broader freedom goals that our constitutional jurisprudence is supposed to promote.
But is there a legal difference between taxing someone to pay for a service and then or forcing them to buy something? Because that also seems
there
to
is
be
a legal, to be clear, and this here resides the most forceful point of the oppositional case, there is a technical doctrinal difference between the government's taxing power and its power to regulate products in the commercial. They rest on different clauses of the Constitution, right, with different jurisprudence. And many may think it's a distinction without a difference. But again, this is a very lawyerly argument against, and it would be a kind of triumph of legalism over constitutional substance,
great,
I think.
Go ahead. Great. Looks like you want to say something, David Nash.
I really respect Ted, and I'm trying to follow the legal implications. You know, it's a little bit like Rome is burning and we're fiddling. So, again, we've got to focus on the issues. I think maybe a good summary might be the triple aim that Dr. Don Berwick tried to promote when he ran Medicare as a sort of overarching goal. And, of course, he got to basically run out of town. But the triple aim. So improve individuals' experience of care, improve the health of the population, hence the name of our school, and reduce per capita cost. That's the triple aim. And I think everybody would agree that's a laudable goal. It's implementable. We've got to do it. I think the issue about the mandate, let's say they strike down the mandate.
Right.
So then today, at this very moment, they're arguing the so-called severability. So even if they strike down the mandate, but they say it's severable, this most of the delivery system reform will continue and will accelerate. So to some extent, we'll have to come back and figure out another way how to cover millions of lives with insurance, but the delivery system reforms are going to continue moving.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this week involving the Affordable Care Act. Our guests are David Nash, the voice you just heard, Ted Ruger, and Dick Pullman. We're going to take a very short break, and we are taking a look at this issue from a medical, legal, and political perspective. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want the Supreme Court to do? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design, offering evening art and design studios for adult men and women at their campus conveniently located in Center City. Programs include graphic design, textile design, and certificates in print and web design, fashion studies, and interior design. The continuing education spring session begins Monday, April 16th. An open house and Career Connect program Sunday, April 1st at 12 noon. Details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
Tonight, it's special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a recap of today's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News. The Supreme Court debates health care.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Walnut Street Theater brings you the Philadelphia premiere of the Tony Award-winning best play, God of Carnage, a comedy of manners without the manners. Two children get into a fight and one gets hurt. The boy's parents meet to discuss the matter in a civilized manner. However, as the evening goes on, the parents become increasingly childish, resulting in unmannered chaos. The internationally acclaimed comedy God of Carnage, now through April 29th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Today is day three, the final day of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court about the Affordable Care Act. At issue is the constitutionality of whether the federal government can compel people to purchase health insurance. We're talking about all of this with Dick Pullman, national political columnist, writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's NewsWorks website. Ted Ruger, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and also with us is David Nash, dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health at Thomas Jefferson University. During the break, we were all jibber-jabbering here, and I'll go to you, Dick Pullman. We're talking about this Affordable Care Act. This was a result of a great deal of debate and a great deal of compromise and passed barely, but certainly signed into law by the president. And yet here it is before the U.S. Supreme Court. Should we be surprised about that?
Well, I think
the politics of that?
Right. Well, you know, the irony was what we were just talking about. The irony, of course, is that it was, you know, it was a grand compromise, and it was a patchwork thing. Everybody sort of gave up pieces to get it. And that was when Obama actually was, you know, sort of in his attempt at bipartisan compromise mode, much more than he is now. But, you know, it still became, but then it's been framed ever since by the Republicans, and successfully in the 2010 elections, you know, as sort of kind of like this, you know, this socialist agenda that was, quote unquote, rammed through. The question, and just, I'm just going to throw in something that we're probably going to end up talking about later on anyway, but just to sort of introduce it, is, okay, so it was had a major effect on the 2010 elections in that way and the Republican success. The question I have is that whether the mandate is approved or upheld or rejected in the next couple months, is it going to be a major factor in the 2012 election? And I don't think it's going to be.
Why not?
Because most people are still, well, a number of reasons. One is for the polls. You look at the polls, and most people say overwhelmingly that the economy is still the most important thing they're looking at. The jobs figures week by week, there's going to be another set of them this week and next week, consumer confidence. That stuff, I think, is much more important. Healthcare is like is in single digits. And I think, you know, the people, whether if it's upheld, the people who hate it now are still going to hate it, and they're going to campaign against it. If it's rejected, the Democrats will try to use it as, you know, they're still going to be for it, and they're still going to try to energize their base in anger, you know, for the fall. So I don't necessarily think it's going to be a major factor.
Well, David, let me go back to you, and we should say that parts of this law have been enacted, and that people under 26 who don't have insurance are covered under their parents' policy.
Exactly right. Our family's very happy. Our fraternal twin 24-year-old daughters will be covered for two more years. In fact, just to get back to Dick's point about the polling, if you look at the Kaiser Family Foundation recent polls, so, do you like to have your kids covered to 26? Awesome. Do you like no prior conditions removed? Yes. Do you like, you know, sticking it to the insurance companies? Absolutely. Do you like the mandate? No. You know, well, makes no sense. And do you believe it's a moral imperative that we cover more citizens and everybody sort of share? Most people actually say, yes, we ought to do that. So there's, I think, the polls. Dick is right. You've got to look a little deeper below the surface, and those Kaiser Family Foundation data is really compelling.
But are you also saying that the Obama administration hasn't done enough to, if not sell, certainly explain this policy?
Excellent
point.
Or is it,
we're talking about something that is so complex,
it's very
hard for people to understand.
I say to our students all the time, this is so complicated, it can't be explained in a 15-second soundbite on Meet the Press. And I think the administration, with all due respect, hasn't done a good communications job because it is complicated, right. But they should all be out on the stump talking about these issues. Let me just tell you one. Last night I was privileged to be at the National Committee on Quality Assurance there. Every other year, big dinner in Washington and all this. This is the group that accredits the managed care industry. Well, Peggy O'Kane, their longtime leader, asked us all to pray that the bill would pass.
Really?
That's right. Because that audience, as the sort of leaders of the policy community, we all agree how important this is to keep moving, keep the momentum, make those system changes. She asked us to pray twice.
Well, that's interesting. Ted, let me turn back to you and go back to the court itself. And much has been made, obviously, by these 3 days of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it's been more than 50 years since something like that has happened. there's a lot of focus on these oral arguments. What happens behind the scenes? Are we overemphasizing what is or isn't said in that court this week?
Well, there's...
Is there any way to know that?
Well, on the one hand, this is a fascinating public event. It is unprecedented, at least for several decades, to have this focused a series of arguments on the same issue. And this is a very... I've listened to tapes from, say, the Warren Court 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, and this is a very active, very intelligent bench in general. They've read... It was clear that most of the justices had read not just the primary briefs, but the copious amicus briefs that had been filed and occasionally made reference to that. What happens behind the scenes, in a sense, and is not the final decision, but will have a huge impact on the outcome, comes this Friday, conference day at the court, where it's a rare event in United States governance where the nine justices go into a room alone,
wow,
even without assistants or clerks or clerical staff, and hash, discuss, and then give their votes. Now, that vote is tentative, and as opinions circulate, if there's justices on the fence, they could decide to join the majority or in a sense, switch their vote and go make a dissent become the majority. But in a sense, we can make inferences from the argument, but we won't know for sure until late June, most likely.
Well, and just listening to the arguments, I mean, it was pretty clear who was opposed and who was against. But you've got this Kennedy, I guess, considered the swing vote. And even Chief Justice Roberts, in his line of questioning, even in his tone of voice, one sensed an openness to the arguments. Am I hallucinating?
I agree with that.
Here?
When I should say, I mean, of course, it's the Solicitor General, the government's attorney, went first because the government is challenging an adverse ruling below in the case in chief. And so he was – so when I think I listened to the 2 hours of oral argument at different times of the day yesterday. And when I listened just to the questions directed at the government, which were quite critical,
yes,
I would have predicted, I think, a loss for the government. Listening to the questions toward the end of the argument to the second lawyer for the opponents of the statute, both Roberts and Kennedy asked questions which indicated that they at least understand the government's basic theory and certainly suggest that they've been thinking about that. So I think it's uncertain at this point.
But those are two perhaps to keep an eye on.
Well, those are the two to keep. It's
right.
Clear that those two will most likely be in the majority no matter which way the court rules.
And for those people that listened, and unfortunately don't get to listen in real time, nor do we get to watch it, which angers me to some degree, was this a vigorous back and forth between the justices and the lawyers?
Absolutely.
I haven't listened to a lot of it. It was a full airing.
I do think because of the length of the arguments and particularly the burden put on the government's lawyer, Solicitor General Don Varelli, who argued Monday, and then he argued yesterday, and I believe is arguing as we speak, unless somebody else is arguing for the government. You know, it's grueling, and there were times when he seemed to be feeling that effect a bit. He was under relentless pressure 2 days in a row, and arguing, I should say, a longer period of time, a full hour, is longer than the normal half hour that he would normally argue in a case.
Yeah, you can't call an injury timeout, you know.
Right. Right, you have to keep going. But, Dick, it's interesting. I guess it was Monday, Rick Santorum showed up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Other people have used the steps there to make their political arguments,
mm-hmm. Well,
largely against the
right. Well, Santorum's using that death knell of freedom argument, which is, I mean, he's still in the business of trying to rally the base of the conservative, Republican Party for the primary. So, you know, so he has his own agenda. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of, on the other hand, we are starting, maybe it's too late, you just came up a few minutes ago, this question of the Democrats done enough to kind of sell this thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, they've been pretty horrible at it. No surprise there in some ways. But they're starting, perhaps it's too late, but they're starting at least to catch up in the sense. Two things have happened in the last week that have been very interesting on that. One is that they have embraced the term Obamacare, which has been pejorative for the last 2 years. Now they're embracing it because they think, as David was saying, there are some affirmative things that they can be selling. You know, the children of the up to the age of 26, children with pre-existing health conditions can get coverage. Stuff like that. So they're trying to sell that affirmatively now. They kind of realize that they have to do that and that they have some wiggle room And to do that, I mean, the polls are actually, I mean, not to go through a million of them here, but they are ambiguous enough and fungible enough that they do have a chance to make a sale. And I noticed last week Obama election campaign put out a 17-minute video narrated by Tom Hanks about what they did the first term. The largest amount of minutes and seconds, because I actually did it with a little stopwatch, of any issue on that video is devoted to health care. And I found that kind of striking.
Ted, are the justices influenced by politics and public opinion polls and people demonstrating outside of the U.S. courthouse?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question and one that law professors and political scientists have struggled with for decades. It's clear that the data shows that the justices have distinct philosophies, perhaps ideologies, and some might call those politics. Whether there's a straight line connection between what's happening today in the Republican and Democratic parties is a little bit more ambiguous. Indeed, these are some of these folks, including key votes like Justice Kennedy, have been on the court now for 25 years or several decades. And so to the extent he has a political view, it may be that of the Republican Party, which appointed him in the 1980s rather than a more recent view.
Although that's a very different Republican Party.
Well, that's right.
But when you go back,
that's right.
There.
So I think it's unclear exactly how the political
story. It's bare knuckle politics, not policy. That's not what we're talking about.
Let me ask you, David, and then I do want to get to our callers, but talking about the millions of people who are uninsured,
right.
What impact, even beyond what's being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, what kind of impact does that have on our health care system as
well,
it exists today?
Sure. So let's pretend they strike down the mandate. Well, the first thing that everyone's going to see is their insurance premiums go up, because how will we otherwise take care of people? So, you know, sure, there's health care inflation, but if you look carefully, actually, in the last 10 to 12 months, we've seen a decrease in overall health care spending, part of it related to the recession, part of it the realization that it's untenable. The delivery system changes are working. If we tinker with this now, I'm very, very concerned about where we're going to go. And, you know, clearly one overnight outcome will be insurance premiums will go up, because that's the only way we're going to be able to continue any kind of coverage. I think also another issue is, you know, what are we going to do in a city like Philadelphia, the poorest city of the nation's top 10 cities, the whole Medicaid conversation that we still have to have here. You know, again, this is all bare-knuckle politics, not policy.
Which seems like an argument for a single-payer system. I mean, not to get overtly
political here. Well, again, let's go back
to
Dick's point about the bill itself. I think it was an amazing act of political compromise early on in the administration's tenure, getting all the core key stakeholders to put up money, future dollars, to get this bill passed. A lot of interesting bedfellows, the pharmaceutical industry, managed care, payers, providers, all participated and essentially all signed off to get it done. And now to come back, you know, 2 years later and take this key piece out of it, again, politics, not policy.
Let me get some callers in. And we have Hugh from Westchester joining us. And Hugh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to point out that there currently is a requirement under both Medicare and Part D prescription drugs that if you don't sign on to the program when you turn 65, you pay a penalty, and you pay that penalty for the entire length of time you're on either of those programs. Why isn't that an individual mandate, and why hasn't that been mentioned as an already existing individual mandate built into the law as it is now?
Well, that's it. I mean, we touched on this earlier, but I think it bears further discussion. Ted,
sure. Well, first of all, the caller's right. As a functional matter, there are mandates all around us. And here, there was one feature of the oral argument when Justice Kennedy characterized this individual mandate as, I think his words were, fundamentally changing the nature of the citizen and the government. And I just couldn't disagree more, in the sense that everybody who works faces mandates to contribute to Medicare and Social Security. Everybody who owns or rents faces mandates to support public schools. Everybody who drives a car faces an insurance mandate. So there are mandates all around us, right. Functionally. This is where, and when I say the judges appear to be asked in some of their questions, acting too much like law professors and not enough like great constitutional judges, is they're splitting hairs based on kind of which clause the power is justified on. Now, that's appropriate in certain cases, but with the most major acts that Congress takes, it's arguable that they should take the view that the great Chief Justice John Marshall did almost 200 years ago, where he said, we should never forget it's a constitution we're expounding. And what he meant by that is this is different than the other stuff that lawyers do. The Constitution is a document intended to endure for ages to come, and should judges should take a broader vision in construing that than they would a technical contract or something like that.
Let me get thanks, Hugh, for the question. We've got Mike from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. And, Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Nationally, we're like disadvantaged by a healthcare system that evolved in sort of like a crazy, unplanned manner, and that's why we're having arguments like we're having right now. I was wondering what your guests would think about thinking about healthcare as like a public utility. I pay my electric bill on a regular basis. I know what I pay, and I get quality service, reliable service, and year-round service. Why shouldn't healthcare operate in a similar fashion?
Well, let me toss that to you, David Nash.
Yeah. Well, certainly pieces of it do operate that way. You know, we all pay taxes, and Medicare is funded out of our taxes, generally speaking. I mean, the perspective here is it's about $1 billion a day for the hospital component alone for Medicare. Medicare's budget is bigger than the GNP of many Western developed nations. Maybe here's a way to reflect on this that really draws it to the individual level. Does anybody feel that they get $8,000 worth of value per person, including children, on an annual basis out of our system? Because that's what we're all paying. $8,000 per person, including children. You know, raise your hand if you think the value equation that we're there yet in getting the return on that kind of investment. And that's why I keep going back to the delivery system changes are so important to help us achieve the value for the money we're already spending.
Dick, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, I was just thinking of I was thinking a little bit of the cognitive dissonance that we heard a few years ago during those town hall summer meetings where people would say, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, it's hysterical.
You know? Right. You know, people just don't make the connection that they're already in the system, that they're already living with this vast social safety net, and that they benefit from it. And they have this notion of like what they do in Western Europe. With single payer and private and socialized medicine, and that it's not a pejorative, that it's not a socialist bugaboo, and but it still is within our politics, fairly or not, there is a very powerful constituency that seeds at this notion of Europe, never mind our terrorist enemies, but Europe, which are our friends, which are, the whole social democratic contract.
Get the government out of my Medicare. Right.
Well, and we heard that.
I just want to say, and express a kind of free market view here, that one of the things that the individual mandate does is it doesn't nationalize the provision of insurance, and indeed there's no public option.
Exactly.
So it's aiming to capture what's best about American private enterprise and innovative organizations like Geisinger here in Pennsylvania or Kaiser out on the West Coast, and say that we're going to let the private insurance and health system innovate, provide better care, reduce costs. We're not going to centralize it in the government.
Yeah, excellent point, which is why it's even more confusing and confounding that the Republicans want to see that piece of it go away.
Well, another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with David Nash, Ted Ruger, and Dick Pullman about arguments this week before the U.S. Supreme Court about the Affordable Care Act. What do you think, and what do you want the court to do? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious or depressed, had mood swings, or been diagnosed with bipolar disorder? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, anxiety, and depression. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. To learn more, 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, conductor Michael Tilson-Thomas tells us about his new PBS special celebrating his grandparents, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski, pioneers of the Yiddish theater. The show features music from the Yiddish stage. Also, a former sports agent comes clean on the dirty business of college football. We talk with Joshua Lux about his new memoir. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. So, if the individual mandate falls, is severed from the health care law, can the law survive? The Supreme Court takes up that and an expansion of Medicaid. Also, the latest on the drinking water in Dimock, Pennsylvania. What was the impact of fracking? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Today is the third and final day of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court about the Affordable Care Act. At issue is the constitutionality of whether the federal government can compel people to purchase health insurance. It's essentially at the heart of the case before the court. Of course, our health care system is a sprawling and expensive system, about 17% of the U.S. economy. We're taking a legal, medical, and political look at this particular issue. And David Nash, professor of health policy at Thomas Jefferson University, in fact, dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health at Thomas Jefferson University, Ted Ruger, law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Dick Pullman, a national political columnist, writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's NewsWorks website. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick, let me go back to you, because in many ways, and you mentioned Obamacare, that the Obama administration has embraced a pejorative, it obviously trying to turn it around, but also part of the convoluted healthcare system that we have is that Obamacare is modeled to a large degree on what Romney approved in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the sort of strange politics mm-hmm. associated with our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because Romney said a number of things in 2006 when he signed the bill. One of which was that you know, the mandate in Massachusetts, you know, could be a model for other states around the country. But also interesting, he said, boy, you know, this idea of if you don't have insurance and you just go into the emergency room and have the taxpayers put the bill, he says, that's a Democratic idea.
Huh.
And, you know, I have to say, just if we're talking for a second about the political realm here, Santorum, in a way, Rick Santorum, in a way, is right when he says that Romney could be potentially giving up, you know, the Republicans, at least rhetorically, best issue in the fall if we get into these debates. And Obama gets up there in the debates and says, Governor Romney, I'd like to thank you for providing us with the model, you know, for health care reform. And although we were also saying, I think, during one of the breaks that it's, again, one of the ironies, of course, is that during the 2008 primaries, Hillary Clinton was much stronger talking about the mandate than Obama was. Right. Obama was actually pretty skeptical about it at the time. So,
in fact, he said, if you make it, if you bring the cost down and make it affordable, more people will buy into the system. But nonetheless, we're talking about the twists and turns. David, let me turn to you, and then I'll get back to our callers. What does it cost for people that have health insurance? How much additional money do people pay to cover people who aren't insured? Do we know the answer?
Well, that's an actuarial question based on different populations. I think one of the key things, again, if they strike down the mandate, then the whole issue of guaranteeability and community rating is going to have to go with it. And that's insurance speak for, if you strike down the mandate, we can't guarantee coverage. Everybody's premiums are going to go up to cover people who don't have coverage and show up at the Jefferson Hospital emergency room. If you look at this city, the amount of uncompensated care that we deliver, even for people who are on Medicaid in our town, is in the tens of millions of dollars. All the hospitals, the medical schools, it's an incredible situation that we're faced with. And that's going to be replicated across the whole country. The whole burden that the states are going to face to try to make this work is going to be continue to be an important policy question.
Let me get David from Yardley to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for making my call. Love
sure.
your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for your callers, and it's something I found frustrating about this whole debate. I really don't know where I stand on the question of constitutionality of the health care law, and I'm a supporter of health care reform. But it seems like the people, even the guests on your show who are supporting the law, they're not really talking about the constitutionality of the law. They're talking about whether health care is a good idea. And it almost feels to me like people are talking about that because they don't want to talk about the constitutionality of the law, so they'd rather say, well, you know, this is really a good idea, we all agree, it's very important, so let's just pass it.
Well, David, it's a good question, and let me give our resident law professor, Ted Ruger, a chance to talk about that.
Sure. Ahead, well, I mean, we're sitting here in the WHYY studios just a stone's throw from where the Constitution was framed over 200 years ago. And, of course, we all know the framers had to come back twice. The Articles of Confederation didn't work. And the reason they didn't work is that the national government didn't have enough authority under that regime. So one of the key meta principles that the framers embodied in the National Constitution was to empower the national government to deal with national solutions. This is a national crisis that requires a national solution. Now, then we go to the proposition that for every action that the national government takes, it needs to link it to an enumerated power, and here that power is the commerce power. The court has construed there's no definitional section here, so this is a creature of evolving judicial interpretation, but here for the last 60 years, there's been a bedrock principle that the national government can regulate individual choices that reverberate through the national economy when aggregated. And the insurance markets, for reasons we've been discussing, I think the reason we've been discussing so much health policy is that this is a special kind of market where one person's choice predictably in kind of actuarial determinate ways is going to affect all of us, and we know that, we can predict that, and thus we can regulate that.
But are you saying there is precedent for the Supreme Court upholding
there's ample precedent for the Supreme Court for Supreme Court upholding congressional regulation of minuscule economic choices, the choice to grow a single marijuana plant in your closet to use yourself for medicinal use, garnered the majority of the court, including folks like Justice Scalia. Now, the way this is novel, although I do think it's a distinction without a difference, is this is requiring, under the commerce power, people to go purchase a product. But we've discussed that's the notion of mandates to purchase or contribute is spread across American law. It's only novel within the narrow boundaries of the Commerce Clause.
David, hopefully that took care of your question. Let me see what looks like Judy from Lower Merion has to say. And Judy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
No one that I have heard comment on the argument, the bill, anything, the process, has said that members of Congress and the Supreme Court have no skin in this game. They have health benefits, virtually all of them, for life, thanks to the American taxpayers. So they never will have to go out into the insurance market to buy health insurance. Rick Santorum has a daughter who has a very serious health condition and probably hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, in health care bills per year. But he's assured of good, excellent coverage because of the taxpayers, because of the benefits that he has from his service in the Senate. The Supreme Court have lifetime health insurance thanks to the American taxpayers. So they have no real sensitivity to what the issues are here in real life.
Well, Judy, I'm going to toss that first to Dick Pullman, who's scribbling furiously as I speak here. Go ahead, Dick.
just so I won't trip over my own words. Okay, so my feeling about that is that the uninsured, if they accept the Republican arguments here, are essentially voting against their own best interests, and I think that happens a lot in our politics, and I think there is a populist, if that's the right word, a populist argument that the Democrats can make here, that the average person, the underdog, the average Joe here who needs insurance. Needs to be wary of the political class here being removed from everyday life and the vicissitudes of everyday life, and that it is, you know, that the uninsured are actually voting in their interests if they heed the argument that health care is essential.
Yeah. Right. David?
Well, I think it's a very astute argument, and I think, and I've read about the Obama campaign, actually, they might take the defeat, let's pretend, the defeat of the mandate and turn it into a populist issue.
Yeah, exactly.
And use it as a very effective campaign tool. To get back to Marty's point, I got an email the other day from the DNC, buy an Obamacare T-shirt. As a fundraising vehicle for the Democratic National Committee. I thought that was great.
Judy, thanks for the call. Let's see what Eric from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Eric, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if your guest thinks that or feel that since this is 3 days' worth of argument and the audio is available online shortly after the session is over,
yes,
do they feel that any of the justices might be tempted or might actually be posturing for political sake, or are they coming at this from an overly legalized point of view, or just is this one guest at a sideshow?
Well, it's an interesting question, Eric, and I'm going to toss that back to you, Ted Ruger.
Well, it's a good question, though I've sat in on a lot of oral arguments when I clerked at the court and have listened to other cases that are less high profile. This is a very active bench. It's a very good bench in terms of questioning. So I didn't see the justices posturing necessarily for the broader national audience. Sometimes they speak to each other. Sometimes they pointedly speak to the lawyers through their questions, and they clearly were doing that. But I think this was I didn't see any ulterior motives except to engage in the normal kind of expressive questioning that this bench is typical of the last few decades of this court.
And should we make anything of the fact that Justice Thomas once again did not ask questions? I mean, that is his.
Well, we shouldn't make anything, right? It's more of the same, right? This is typical over his entire tenure on the bench, and it's quite notable. And
yes, it is. Considering there was some pretty vigorous back and forth from,
and we know he has very strong feelings on the Commerce Clause.
I was looking at the Dick Pullman here. I was looking at the transcript online, and one of the first things I did was I did a Control F for the name Thomas, and it came all the way to the end. I went, okay, I just wanted to make sure. Can I actually direct the question to Ted? This is something interesting that I was wondering. Is everybody saying, "Oh God, the thing is doomed because of Anthony"? Because Anthony Kennedy was asking such sharp questions about precedent and you know what this was going to mean for the future of the government's power and stuff. Can it be argued in the other way around that he was just perhaps trying to make the most pointed devil's advocate questions, arguably to reassure himself in case he did vote to uphold? Yeah.
Sure. I think that I would be very hesitant to infer too much from oral argument. I think at the very least, though, what we can take from this is the justices think this is a very hard and very close case, which I should say, and in a sense to credit the legal effort on the oppositional side, nobody in the legal academy would have thought this 2 years ago.
Really?
This is a social movement on the conservative side transmuted through law that has really changed our constitutional understanding. But, and whether or not we would agree with it, the lawyering on the oppositional side has really been tremendous.
But speaking about social movement, you know, what kind of country do we want to have? Where's the social justice question? Do we want to cover these millions of citizens or not? We have a patchwork quilt bill. It's not the best thing. It is working. The changes are happening. Again, I think the core moral question is still a critical one that we haven't really answered.
Let me get, looks like Carl from Lansdale to join our conversation. Carl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Thank
Hi.
You very much
You're
for
very
taking
welcome.
My call.
Sure.
Just a couple things. Presently, the insurance companies are dropping 50,000 people per year at their discretion, and you have no recourse. Obamacare prevents that. Also, $1,000 of our present policy is used to pay the for the uninsured. So we're already paying to help those people. And also, 20% of the revenue that Aetna receives goes for health care. And I've been told that Medicare, 94% of their revenues go to health care.
Well, Carl, I'm glad you called because I know David Nash wants to respond to your comments.
Yeah, there's an awful lot there. Let me just tackle the one piece. So the silly term medical loss ratio. So insurance companies, both for-profit and not-for-profit, spend 85 cents of every dollar on care itself. And now that's mandated in the law. So I can't comment on the dropping of patients and so on. But again, to Dick's comment, the insurance industry put up a lot of money to participate in the conversation. They didn't get everything they wanted for sure, but they got enough. And this town's a great representation. We have for-profit plans, not-for-profit plans, everybody coexisting. It's not perfect, but we could cover everybody if everybody puts his money in the pot. That's the take-home message.
Well, and even going back to you, Dick Pullman, it seems like you're saying that maybe no matter how the court rules, this will not be a a dominant issue in this election year. And interestingly, mm-hmm. the judgment will come down in June. And that's the kind of start of the general election campaign this year.
But you know, with our 24/7 news cycle, June is light years away from the last week of October when everybody's going to be, you know, I mean, at most, I mean, this is, predictions are very hazardous.
Yes.
And I assume we're going to, you know, these gentlemen are going to predict about the court. But my only political prediction that I'm feeling pretty comfortable about is that if the mandate is struck down, that the Democrats will try to sort of use that as a galvanizing tool to say, look what is being taken away from you, voter, in your everyday life. And there might even be more talk about how, you know, the Supreme Court is at stake in this election, too, because the next president is going to fill certain seats. And look what happened when Bush won re-election in 2004, you know, and he got to fill a couple seats. And so, you know, there's always that.
Well, we are almost out of time here. I don't know. Tag Ruger, do you want to go out on a limb and make a prediction, or is it too soon to tell? And just,
well, I'll make a prediction, which is emphatically not out on a limb, in the sense that I think this the argument convinces me that the justice for this is a close case for the key justices like Kennedy and Roberts. Right. I was at about a 75% confidence level that the court would affirm it before this week. Now I would ratchet that down to about 60%. I still think they'll affirm it, though, because to strike it down would be the most activist declaration of unconstitutionality since the early New Deal, which caused the court packing crisis.
Right. How about for you? Final word.
I think
David
they're going to affirm it, and I think we need to think about a whole new type of medicine, and that is practicing population-based care. If we can do that, reduce waste, reduce error, we'll have enough money to cover everybody.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. David Nash is the dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health at Thomas Jefferson University, Ted Ruger, law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and Dick Pullman, a national political columnist. He writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's NewsWorks website, also the American Debate column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You go to our Facebook page and see what our guests look like. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. And